rumor going around. Going to be some big bucks trading hands during some of the commercial times, aren't there? Well, you know, you guys reading through your Bible, that Bible in a year, 1 year Bible. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but Bible is just an amazing book. Do you know? You may not know this, but do you know? I discovered it this week. The Bible has the ability to predict the outcome of the Super Bowl. Amazing but true. Let me show you. I was flabbergasted too. I was just beside myself with amazement. But I actually did some research, and I've got the proof with me right here, right now. For example, Bible Super Bowl pick. Exodus 9:3, the hand of the Lord will bring a terrible plague on your horses. That is, whenever you see in the Bible the word horse or horses, it's cryptic for colts, okay? Joshua 11:6, the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow, I'll hand them all over to you, slain. You are to hamstring their horses. Ezekiel 39:20, at my table you will eat your fill of the colts. Micah 5:10, in that day, declares the Lord, I will destroy your horses. Not looking too good for the colts, is it? On the other hand, though, I found 1 Samuel 2:9, he will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked will be silenced in darkness. Psalm 16:3, as for the saints who are in the land, land is prophetic speech for Super Bowl stadium, they, the saints, are the glorious ones in whom is all my delight. Wow. Psalm 132, 9, may your priests be clothed with righteousness, may your saints sing for joy. Now here's the clicker, the clincher, Daniel 7:18. This puts a lock on it. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom. See, that also is prophetic language for the Super Bowl trophy. So there you have it. I wouldn't bet the farm on it, but there you have it for what it's worth. Okay. Yeah, I had too much time on my hands this week, I guess. You know, we've spent a year, all last year, studying God's story and trying to discover really what it means for us. And God's story tells us that, remember Forrest Gump asked that very profound question, do we just show up kind of accidental-like and float around like a feather on a breeze? God's story says no. We have meaning and purpose. Our lives mean something. Our existence is not an accident. We were created to occupy the earth, to fill it up with people and good things, to use our God-given creativity and abilities to be a productive contributor to the community in which we live. Every one of you, every one of us, without exception, has been graced by God in some way to make a difference. Every one of us has received abilities and talents and skills and propensities toward things that enable us to make this broken planet a little bit better than it would have been without us if we employ those things toward God's glory. Peter put it this way in 1 Peter 4:10, each one should use whatever gift, and that's literally the word grace, whatever grace he has received to serve others as good stewards of God's grace in its various forms. And it has all kinds of various forms to it. Now, a little aside here, that everything we're going to be talking about this year, we're going to do a lot of topical studies, could really be put under the heading of stewardship. Since God has graced us to serve others, we are expected to use those graces, those gifts, those talents, those abilities, that knowledge as good stewards of what God has entrusted to our care. Stewardship is not just about money. So many times we think of it in terms of, uh-oh, here comes, give us money, give us money. No, stewardship is not just about money. It's about how we engage with our families and our friends and our community. It's about how we conduct ourselves on the job, how we treat the environment, and how we invest our time and energy. And yes, it does involve money. It's about how we invest our money. But stewardship, and this is really important that you get this, encompasses the entirety of our lives. It's about everything. Stewardship is a recognition that there is a God and that everything belongs to Him. So, if there is a Creator, and if there is a God, and it all belongs to Him, how should we live? What difference does it make knowing that? Well, that's going to be the subject of that we're going to be, in one way or another, talking about this entire year. We're going to try to discover what God's story says about a variety of topics that we are confronted with every day. Now, Dan started, I think, a couple weeks ago, talking about relationships, our relationships, and how that fits into God's story and our stewardship of those. And he noted that there are four ingredients that are necessary for healthy relationships. There's authenticity, which is being yourself; vulnerability, sharing yourself honestly; credibility, being a person who is worthy of trust; and compatibility, getting along with other people. All of these things are absolutely necessary in order for us to have healthy relationships with one another. They're also required if we're going to fulfill our God-given purpose and responsibility of carrying the good news about Jesus and that there is a Creator and that people do matter to the rest of the world. So today, I want to focus our attention on credibility. And Dan referred to something that George Gallup had said. He said, "Never has Christianity had more inroads, more Bibles, more sermons, more churches, more ways to get the word out, and yet, where's the beef?" In other words, he's saying we have a serious credibility gap, and that's probably what gets in the way more than the message itself does. So how should we live? Now, remember, there were some very important turning points in God's story that got us to where we are today. You remember a major one we saw in Exodus 19, where we see the Hebrews going into Sinai. This marks a new day for the Hebrew people. They go from being what the Bible calls an Erev Rav. Most of your translations render that mixed multitude. They're this ragtag group of nobodies, and they become the nation Israel with a new identity and a new purpose. God says there that they are to be a holy people. In other words, they're to be a unique people who are set apart to live a distinctive lifestyle. That's really what it means to be holy, to be set apart, to be consecrated to sacred purposes, or to stand apart like God does. He is holy because there is none other like Him. But they're also to be a nation of priests, and in that they're to proclaim His word. They're to tell God's story and tell the world about Him. They're to intercede for people and help people, the nations, find God. And he says that repeatedly, that in Abraham, in these people, all the nations will be blessed. We saw another big turning point in Acts 2, and on the day of Pentecost, it marks a new day in God's dealing with people, with the birth of the church, people in general. Because now, in the church, Jews and Gentiles together are united as a new people with a new purpose, very much parallel to Israel or similar to Israel. They were to be a holy people, a holy nation, and a nation of priests. And our commission is also to represent God to the nations of the world, proclaim His word, intercede for people, and help people from all nations, tribes, and tongues find God. Now, you couple that with Acts 16, another turning point. It's a big day for the Gentile nations when Paul, the apostle, turns west instead of east and enters Europe. And Europe eventually becomes the center of activity for world outreach. And speaking later about this new body and this new people, Peter says in 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of Him who called you out of darkness into His wonderful light." Now, when it says declare His praises, it doesn't mean sing songs, which we've just done. That is one way to declare his praises. But really, he's talking about being that holy nation, those holy people that are distinct and have distinct lifestyles from those around them. And he says, once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So if that's true, how should we live? Well, in the next two verses, verse 11 and 12, he tells us, dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives, holy lives, if you will, among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Now, we not only in these verses have the how we should live, but also the why we should live that way. The message puts it, I think, in a way that's really hard to miss. He says, friends, this world is not your home, so don't make yourself cozy in it. That's a good reminder, isn't it? Don't indulge your ego at the expense of your soul. Live an exemplary life among the natives so that your actions will refute their prejudices. Then they'll be won over to God's side and be there to join us in the celebration when he arrives. Now, I do a lot of traveling around, and I see a lot of different things that are done under the name of Christianity. And I have to tell you, I think the world is justifiably skeptical about the claims of religious people and religious organizations, especially in light of Gallup's observation. We have all the latest technology, all the latest techniques to share the good news with the world, but often lack the credibility to be believed. Our job as followers of Jesus is to gain credibility for ourselves, for the message that we proclaim as truth, and in order to give the unbelieving world a reason to reconsider their resistance to Christ. Now, I want to raise and try to answer for you three questions about credibility. What is it? How do you get it? And why is it important to us? First of all, what is it? A simple dictionary definition, I think, will suffice. It is the credibility is the quality of being believable and trustworthy. How many of you are old enough to remember E.F. Hutton? You don't have to admit it. Remember, E.F. Hutton was an investment company back in the 80s that literally made credibility their trademark in commercials like this.
All right, children, who's going to be the first one to recite the alphabet? How about you, Ann?
A, B, C, D, E, F, E, F, E, F, Hutton.
When E, F, Hutton talks, people listen.
You remember those commercials? When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. Well, you know what? When you have credibility, people listen also. So that's what credibility is. How do you get it? I'm not usually big on formulaic living because I don't think formulas work in the real world and in real life, but I'm going to make an exception today and give you a formula to follow regarding credibility. And it's this: relationship plus reliability plus time equals credibility. So let's kind of dissect this a little bit and define some terms here. Number one, relationship. This is the connection between two or more people or groups and their involvement with each other, especially as regards how they behave and feel toward each other and communicate or cooperate with one another. In order to have credibility, or to even need credibility, there has to be some kind of a connection. And so this is what I would call the context of credibility. There has to be some kind of a context or some kind of connection, some kind of relationship in order to make credibility even an issue. If I don't know a person or see them or have any dealings with them, our lives do not overlap at all, it really doesn't matter if they're a liar or not, or if they're credible or not, because it doesn't have any impact on my life. It only begins to impact my life in the context of relationships And then it becomes a very big issue, doesn't it? Reliability is the quality of being dependable or reliable. It is being able to be trusted to do what is expected or has been promised. Now, if you lack reliability, if you're unreliable, it breaks, or at the very best, damages the relationship. It damages, weakens that connection, because you get lied to often enough by someone who has no credibility. It starts to shake your confidence in and weaken the relationship itself. This is what I would call the glue of credibility. It's what holds the whole thing together. Proverbs 3:3-4 has become a very, very important couple of verses for me. And I kind of want to unwrap it a little bit for us here today. He says there, "Let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart." Now, when he's talking about love and faithfulness, what's he mean by that? What's he referring to? Well, Expositor's Bible Commentary identifies love as referring either to a friendship, to a family love, a relationship, or a covenant loyalty, where you enter in some kind of a binding agreement with someone else. It literally means this. It's not a feeling, by the way. It is a behavior. We often confuse love with a feeling, but it's not a feeling. It is a behavior. It may be accompanied by feelings, but it is first and foremost a behavior. And it is this: fidelity to obligations arising from a relationship. Now, Valentine's coming. Can't you just see that on a Hallmark card? You open it up. "I will be faithful to all obligations that arise from our relationship." Wow, doesn't that just warm your heart? Probably not, huh, ladies? But see, the feeling is what sells all the chocolates and the flowers and the cards. Not that cold feeling, that definition. I will be faithful to all the obligations that our relationship brings. But that's really at its heart what it is. Faithfulness is that which can be relied upon. It is that which is stable. Okay, and Expositor Bible Commentary notes that this is a really unique and important connection of these two words, love and faithfulness. They say this is a key Old Testament word pairing that suggests the making and keeping of commitments. He's really talking about relationships with one another and reliability. Relationships in which we commit ourselves to other people, and our reliability when we fall through and carry through with our promises or with any obligations that happen to arise because of that that commitment, that relationship. And he says that we are to bind them around your neck and write them on the tablet of your heart. And what he's saying here poetically is he's stressing that these two qualities should become part of our very nature, that they become a part, an essential part of who we are. In other words, he's saying, you know, you should be the poster children of what it looks like to be loving and reliable. When you look up these two words, your picture should be in the dictionary right by them. He's saying, don't miss this. Make sure this characterizes who you are. And he says, if you'll do that, in verse 4, then you will win favor and a good name in the sight of God and man. A good name is another way of saying a good reputation, or you will have credibility. Now, there's another very important ingredient that is often overlooked with respect to credibility, and that is time. Time really is an important factor. And in 1 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 10, we read some interesting things. Paul is writing to Timothy, and he's talking about people who are qualified to lead the church. And he talks about elders, which are pastors. That would be the equivalent of myself and Dan and Noah and Rex. Okay. Then he shifts his attention later on in that passage to deacons. The word he uses is deacons there. That simply means a servant. And these, I believe, are people who serve the church in some official capacity. They represent the church and serve the church in an official way, like Lori in children's ministry, or Julie in the nursery, or Corbett in student ministries. They're really deacons, is what he has on his mind here, I believe. And he says this, this is a trustworthy saying, if someone aspires to be an elder, he desires an honorable position. So an elder must be a man whose life is above reproach. He must be faithful to his wife, he must exercise self-control, live wisely, and have a good reputation. He must be hospitable, and he must be able to teach. He must not be a heavy drinker or violent. He must be gentle, not quarrelsome, and not love money. He must manage his own family well, having children who respect and obey him. For if a man cannot manage his own household, how can he take care of God's church? An elder must not be a new believer. There should be some time elapsed between his submission to Christ and when you're choosing him or considering him for this leadership. Also, people outside the church must speak well of him so that he will not be disgraced and fall into the devil's trap. It's a real good description of credibility, isn't it? He should be a person who is credible in all areas of life. And then he says, in the same way, deacons must be well respected and have integrity. They must not be heavy drinkers or dishonest with money. They must be committed to the mystery of the faith now revealed and must live with a clear conscience. Before they are appointed as deacons, let them be tested. And if they pass the test, then let them serve. Now, the word tested there is the Greek word from which we get our word document or documentation or documented. And the lesson here is that credibility is absolutely required for church leadership, not popularity. Credibility. And it is earned over time and after the person's character has been observed and tested and made sure that the person has credibility. Now, sometimes this documentation process results in discovering that the person lacks credibility. Revelation 2:2, John writes to the church at Ephesus, I know your deeds, your hard work, and your perseverance. I know that you cannot tolerate wicked men, that you have tested those who claim to be apostles, but are not. See, you didn't just take their claim on face value, you actually tested them. You documented whether their claims were true or not, and you found them to be not true, and you have found them false. You didn't just take their word for it, but you actually took the time and spent some time documenting their claims. Point is, it takes time to judge a person's character and determine if they are credible people. Time is what I would call the proof of credibility. Now, what does credibility look like? I thought, you know, it might be good. This has really been a big issue for me for many years, especially in light of my occupation. So I just want to kind of share a few things of what it looks like in my life. And you may have noticed that I often disappear at times, you know, frequently and sometimes for weeks at a time. I'm going to disappear again this week. That's not because aliens are frequently snatching me up and picking my brain. I'm not being abducted by aliens or taken up into spaceships, but actually it's because of my other job as a missionary. I'm a missionary with Missions Door, and I've been working with the Navajo for going on 12 years now, 11 or 12 years. And it's been a real interesting process and a very learning process and experience for me. The first place that we set up camp and started working from was a town called Kaibato. It's in the northern part of Arizona. And we housed our group. There's about 200 high school students coming out. And we housed them in a boarding school there in Kaibato. And I did some legwork for about a year, recon and setting things up. And it was really interesting. We had a bunch of houses that we were working on and a few community buildings and that kind of thing. And it was kind of shocking because the people wouldn't talk to us. I was developing some growing relationships with a few of the key people in town. But by and large, whenever any of our group would get near them, they would leave. We'd show up at their house. They'd be gone. You wouldn't see them. You couldn't get within 50 yards of an Navajo. The school was within walking distance of a little market there, Kaibato Market, and they'd go over there for junk food. And the Navajo people, when they would get in line to check out, the Navajo would switch from English to Navajo. So we couldn't even understand what they're talking about. And, you know, we were persona non grata. It left us feeling kind of empty and unappreciated, which gave us an opportunity to check our motives and our attitudes. And it was a real shock, because we were used to, you know, being treated by the Mexican people like, man, you just liberated Paris. You know, you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. These guys didn't play the game. Well, a little while later, I started understanding why they didn't play the game and why they weren't patting us on the back. And my first shocker was an article that I read. The title was, "They Came with a Bible in One Hand and a Gun in the Other." And it's like, oh, I sort of see the picture here. The other thing that I started noticing over time was there were a few other groups, a couple of groups, one from Ohio, one from Louisiana, that used the same dorms that we did. And I would come in behind them, and there would be broken windows, or the place would be a mess. They wouldn't clean up behind themselves. They wouldn't say goodbye. One group left town, left the keys to the dorms at the post office. And I'm like, that's totally rude, you know? I mean, I wouldn't talk to you either. And they were bossy. They told them what they needed and what they didn't do, what they were doing wrong, and, you know, all this stuff. So I thought, well, okay, I see what my job is we got a lot of bad press that we have to overcome here. Real early on, in fact, I was still doing the recon and the setup for the group. I was introduced to a guy named Lewis. And I was told after Lewis left our presence by the Navajo guy introducing us, he says, now look, a lot of Navajo guys don't like white people, but Lewis doesn't like anybody. So if he's rude to you and that, don't take it personally. He treats us all that way. Okay, I got it. The first year, it was like, man, we are, you know, slug slime to these people. And it kind of broke our hearts and hurt our feelings a little bit. We were not used to that. Second year got a little better. A few more people started talking to us. By the way, the first year, I decided we had some bad PR to overcome, so we fixed everything that was broken in the dorms, and we cleaned everything. And I told the groups, I had my daughters be dorm Nazis, and you had to pass literally a white glove inspection if you were going to go home, and created a lot of tension between people that wanted to get on the road. We're done, you know, we're heroes, we're out of here. And we told them, no, the job's not done until this place not only is clean, but it smells clean. That first year, I wasn't pleased with the floors. I wasn't totally satisfied. So our group from Sierra was finishing up another little project. And so I took the buffers out, and I buffed the floors in this entire dormitory by myself till they shined. So back to Lewis. He didn't like anybody. Second year, they're a little more friendly. Lewis is a little more friendly. Third year, we come to about our fifth principal, and she is a real hard case. And it was pretty obvious that she was very antagonistic toward our group. She didn't like anybody using her school, and especially us. She just didn't like Christian groups. She didn't want anything to do with it. So it became real obvious that we were going to have to move. So I started working that direction. Now, in the process of being there at Kaibato, I developed a check-in sheet, because I was in the early stages, I was being confused with the ones that tore things up. So I wanted to make sure that we know what was torn up and what's not when I leave. So I'd walk through with Lewis, we'd check everything off, and then we'd walk through at the end of the week, he'd see that we'd fixed all that stuff and cleaned it up, and it was good. The third year, Lewis and I, doesn't like anybody, especially me, or white people. We get to the end of the dorms, last cubicle, he's checking the stuff off, and he says, man, I hope you guys can come back next year, because it was looking not too good. Well, the short story is we weren't allowed to come back that year. The principal lost her job over it because we moved to Shanto from Kaibato, much better facilities, by the way. And talk about a change in the man's reception of us. One of the guys that I got to meet, he was the president of the chapter. That's kind of like the county seat. He would be equivalent to like a county commissioner. And he would come every year and he'd say, where are you guys from? Because he'd always get confused. And I'd say, mostly California. And he'd say, why are you coming all the way out here to help us? And I'd say, well, because Jesus came all the way from heaven to help us, and we're just following his example. And I, you know, you could see he just expected the hook to be set somewhere along the line, and it never was set because there was no hook. And so a couple years later, I'm talking to the guy that owns the Kaibuto Market, and we've become pretty good friends. And he's telling me about a conversation he and Philip had with one another, and Philip is bemoaning the fact that, we won't walk across the street to help one another, and these knuckleheads come all the way out from California and do all this work in our community. And he says, why can't we be more like them, referring to us? Why can't we follow their pattern and be a little bit more like them? He started to go to church, to their Bible study that they started there at the market. I mean, talk about a change. A few more signs that I've noticed. A couple years ago, I was invited to be a part of the delegation, the official delegation that went from the Inscription House chapter and carried a proclamation of some sort by horseback across country to the capital over at Window Rock. Unfortunately, my wife had just had surgery and I was unable to go. I've later discovered that was probably the grace of God that I couldn't go, because those guys ride like maniacs. I probably still wouldn't be able to walk if I'd have gone. But what an honor to be invited. I mean, I'm an outsider. I'm the bonehead white guy from California, and they're inviting me to be part of their delegation. I've been invited to help build a church building because of my reputation of not being pushy and being a know-it-all. I've been invited to birthday parties. Just before Christmas, right around Christmas time, I was called one morning by the son of a pastor that I've been working with to let me know that his father had passed away that morning. I must have been one of the first people he called. I was like, what an honor. Why would you even have me in your mind on your phone list? And I've seen the widespread acceptance. They treat me like one of the community fixtures everywhere I go around there. And this is pretty big, they will even correct me when I get out of line. Now, that's pretty big, because we have some credibility. We have a relationship that says, I want to learn, and I screw up, and you teach me and correct me. There's that credibility there. And here's the thing that I keep hearing probably more than anything, is you keep coming back. There's that time thing. You keep coming back. Yeah, after 11 years, you'd start to see a pattern. And it still surprises them sometimes that we keep coming back. Well, this year has been really interesting, because now I've been invited to begin that whole process with the Pueblo over in the Albuquerque area. And I'll be visiting them actually this coming weekend. And they do, you might pray for them. They face some real unique challenges when they commit themselves to follow Jesus. Here's the thing. Relationship, I work a lot on building relationships. I put, fly into Phoenix and put 2,000 miles on a rental car just seeing people and saying hi. Plus reliability, keeping your word. Are you dependable? Are you stable? And time. They have watched me over time, over 11 years, and they have judged me. They have documented me. And they said, this is a credible person. Well, if that's what credibility is, why is it important to me? Why is it important to us? Well, a couple of reasons. One is that it is literally impossible to build a meaningful relationship if we or the people with whom we're trying to have a relationship with, if either of us lack credibility. You know, if you can't trust what the other person is telling you, or that they will keep their word, or that they will live up to those responsibilities that come along with relationships, you're not going to have a very deep or very stable relationship, are you? A lot of you guys reading through the Bible, the Bible, daily Bible, did you notice there are some examples of credibility and maybe what it isn't, how difficult it is to have a relationship? I was reading, we read about Laban not too long ago and Jacob. Jacob went down to Laban's country and fell in love instantly with Rachel. She was beautiful. He loved her the moment he saw her. And he agreed to go to work for Laban, his father-in-law, for 7 years if Laban would give her to him as his wife. And so he worked 7 years for her. And on the morning after the wedding, don't ask me how this happened, he wakes up and Rachel's not there. It's Leah. And he's married to Leah. Now, I don't know how that happens to you. I don't know. I'm even more, you know, I have more clues than that, you know, but he must have been clueless. I don't know. So he works another 7 years to get Rachel. You couldn't trust good old Laban very well, could you? I love their parting words. In Bible college, this was always one of those things when you went off to spring break or summer break and you kind of had this boy-girl thing going on, that the girls especially would swoon over this. May the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other. You know what? Read the context. That is not a blessing. That is like me as a dad saying to the guy that comes to pick my daughter up for a date, I'm watching you. And you cross the line and I'll know and I will tear your heart out. That's what he's saying. He's saying we have made a covenant. We're going to stay away from each other because we're not getting along. And God help whoever breaks this covenant. You know, not a real warm fuzzy thing there, is it? Another one that I thought was just hilarious is good old Aaron. You know, he was Moses' brother, his sidekick. Moses goes up on the mountain to meet with God and leaves Aaron in charge. Not the best move. As he comes down, he's with Joshua, and they hear this commotion going on down the camp. Joshua thinks it's a battle. It's a battle. We're being attacked. And Moses says, no, I think it's more like a raucous party. And so they get down there, and sure enough, these guys are dancing and singing and carrying on and worshiping this golden calf. I love Aaron's explanation to Moses. Don't be angry, my Lord. You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. So I said to them, well, okay, whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off. Then they gave me the gold, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. I don't know how it happened. It just did, man. My dog ate my homework. I did it. Trust me. Would you trust either of these two guys very far? Probably not as far as you could throw them, would you? Now, in your reading, as you continue to read through the Bible, especially the Old Testament, where we're heading for, notice Joshua and Caleb and the difference in their character from these two guys. And you'll see men that you can count on to do what they say. There are men that are credible. And if they make a promise, they will die trying to fulfill it. So it's impossible to have a relationship if it lacks credibility on either side. Credibility is also the thing that, in the words of the Message that we read a minute ago, that will refute the prejudices of the critical, unbelieving world. See, earning credibility is what changed the Navajo's attitude toward me as they watched me over years keep my word. And in many ways, it's even changed our attitude toward Christianity. But I want to share an example that is just mind-boggling. This comes out of the Times Online. It's a publication out of London. And this guy is an atheist. Now, there's some copies on the Get Connected table if you want one, or the URL is in your notes if you want to log on there. And Noah's posted a link to it on our blog, so there's several different ways you can get it and read the whole article. I'm going to read about half of it. But he says this. He says, before Christmas, I returned after 45 years to the country as a boy I knew as Naya Saland. Now, he's writing this just before this Christmas, so he's kind of, that's what the article's about. Today, it's Malawi, and the Times, their Christmas appeal, includes a small British charity working here. Pump Aid, that's the name of the charity, helps rural communities install simple pumps, letting people keep their village wells sealed and clean. I went to see this work, he says. It inspired me, renewing my flagging faith in development charities. But traveling to Malawi refreshed another belief too. One I've been trying to banish all my life, but an observation I've been unable to avoid since my African childhood. It confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, and has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now, a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the world, from the work of secular NGOs. Those are non-government organizations, and government projects and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. I used to avoid this truth by applauding, as you can, the practical work of mission churches in Africa. It's a pity, I would say, that salvation is a part of the package. But Christians, black and white, working in Africa, do heal the sick, do teach people to read and write, and only the severest kind of secularist could see that a mission hospital or school and say the world would be better without them. I would allow that if faith was needed to motivate missionaries to help them, then fine. But what counted was the help, not the faith. But this doesn't fit the facts. Faith does more than support the missionary. It is also transferred to his flock. This is the effect that matters so immensely and which I cannot help observing. First, then the observation. We had friends who were missionaries, and as a child, I stayed with them often. I also stayed alone with my little brother in a traditional rural African village. In the city, we had working for us Africans who were converted and were strong believers. The Christians were always different. Far from having cowed or confined its converts, their faith appeared to have liberated and relaxed them. There was a liveliness, a curiosity, an engagement with the world, a directness in their dealings with others that seemed to be missing in traditional African life. They stood tall. At 24, traveling by land across the continent reinforced this impression. From Algiers to Nigeria, Cameroon, and the Central African Republic, and right through the Congo to Rwanda, Tanzania, and Kenya, four student friends and I drove our old Land Rover to Nairobi. We slept under the stars, so it was important as we reached the more populated and lawless parts of the sub-Sahara that every day we find somewhere safe by nightfall, often near a mission. Whenever we entered a territory worked by missionaries, we had to acknowledge that something changed in the faces of the people that we passed and spoke to. Something in their eyes, the way they approached you direct, man to man, without looking down or away. They had not become more deferential towards strangers, in some way less so, but more open. This time in Malawi, it was the same. I met no missionaries. You do not encounter missionaries in the lobbies of expensive hotels discussing development strategy documents as you do with the big NGOs. But instead, I noticed that a handful of the most impressive African members of the Pump Aid team, largely from Zimbabwe, were privately strong Christians. Privately, because the charity is entirely secular, and I never heard any of its team so much as mention religion while working in the villages. But I picked up the Christian references in our conversations. One I saw was studying a devotional textbook in the car. One on Sunday went off to church at dawn for a two-hour service. It would suit me to believe that their honesty, diligence, and optimism in their work was unconnected with personal faith. Their work was secular, but surely affected by what they are. What they were was in turn influenced by a conception of man's place in the universe that Christianity had taught. So these are people who have connected with God's story. They understand what they're here for, and they're actively engaged in the process as God brings restoration and healing and redemption to this broken planet. And it shows. And it is undeniable, even to a committed atheist. Let me close with two scriptures that you can literally build your life around, and I hope you will take to heart and memorize. Proverbs 3:3-4. Let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Then you will win favor and a good name in the sight of God and man. And 2 Peter 2:12. Live an exemplary life among the natives so that your actions will refute their prejudices. Then they will be won over to God's side and be there to join in the celebration when he arrives. At all times and by all means, preach the gospel. And if necessary, use words. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that you would burn these verses, these words, into our hearts and our minds, and that they would cease to be just words and verses, but that they would become a part of our DNA, a part of who we are, at the core of who we are, so that one, we will have and establish and make good, healthy relationships with our families and our community and with one another. But also that it will show through our lives as it has in these African believers and be unrefutable. And may it provoke an unbelieving world that is watching us to re-examine their beliefs about Christ and be attracted to him and drawn to him. Amen.